Well, verse number 12, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to walk through the verses, and I hope that you will really follow along tonight. This is a teaching time. I'm going to teach through these verses, verse by verse. And so if you can really take some notes tonight and really study this out, this is very, very profound. In verse number 12, he starts out with this declaration of being a king. Notice what it says in verse 12. He says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now, these inscriptions were meant to enhance respect for kings and to memorialize their achievements forever. And so, rather than his accomplishments proving his unsurpassed greatness, he concludes that really being a king or having riches or having what he has really doesn't matter in the end, is what he's saying. I was the king. Obviously, Solomon is speaking at the end of his life, okay? And he says they don't provide satisfaction. They're not providing fulfillment. They're not providing any kind of meaning for life. And Solomon is the standard of excellence in all areas of man's goal-oriented life. So whatever goal you have out there, Solomon's like, I'm the standard. I've been there. Riches, nobody's ever been richer than Solomon. Nobody's had more power than Solomon. Nobody's had more prestigious relationships than Solomon. Solomon is this kind of person who is the standard of all goal-oriented achievement in life. So whatever it is that you're striving after to find meaning in life. By the way, I hope you guys understand something. I'm not saying you shouldn't be goal-oriented, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't strive for better. I'm not saying you shouldn't pursue education or pursue a job that pays a little bit higher and to have some goals in life, but to think for a second that achieving those goals will finally give you meaning in life, you'll find that you're just simply chasing the wind. He is the standard of all goal-oriented pursuits. And what's so interesting, you think about his power, his money, his relationships, the pleasures, the projects that he was behind, he's been there. And Solomon is trying to get the reader to see that such a life that is not God-centered results in the same emptiness that he's experienced, the same frustration. He said, all of it's vexation of spirit. All of it feels empty. I'm just so frustrated. I thought it would provide meaning and fulfillment, and it never did. And so he's going through all of his achievements in chapters 1 and chapter 2 and throughout the entire book, all the things that he's accomplished and found that there was no meaning in them. Now, as we're reading these verses, you can take the verses off the screen if you'd like. I'm going to go through these later. But if you notice in here, in verse number 12, how does the verse start? What word? Okay. In verse number 14, how does it start? All right. And in verse 16, and in the second word in verse 17, I mean, when you read these verses today, all the way through chapter 2 and verse 11, you find that he uses a lot of the words of I, me, and my. I did this when I was considering. A lot of I's, me's, and my's, which show what he's trying to reveal to us in using this type of language is that it shows the limits to such an approach to life. Like, I've tried to pursue all these things, and I found them all to be empty, especially because it was void of a God-centered life. So I want to just share with you tonight two more frustrations of life. Last week, we looked at other frustrations. Tonight, we're going to look at the frustration of wisdom and the frustration of wealth. So if you would, look at verse number 12, if you would. Through 18, verses 12 through 18 of chapter 1. Let me read these verses. He says, I, the preacher, speaking of wisdom, okay? I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I gave my heart to seek and to search out by what? Wisdom concerning all things that are done under the sun. This sore travail, in other words, another way you could put that is this burden that I carry, hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. In other words, like the want of man, like what we desire and strive after, there's the number of the things that we strive after is so numerous, they can't even be numbered. I communed with my own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Yeah. So we see here the frustration of wisdom in verses 12 through 18. You would think that the more wisdom you have, it would lead to a better life. You would think that if I asked God for more wisdom, and I got more wisdom, and I read more books, and I got more degrees, that it would lead to a much better life. But if you notice in verses 12 through 13, that's not the case, is it? He says, I gave my heart, in verse 13, to search wisdom and concerning all things that are done under the heaven. This sore travail, this burden, hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. The preacher confronts this, Solomon confronts us with a situation that we might call today existentialism, which means man exists in a series of experiences and cannot discover any onward meaning to them. So we exist in a series of experiences in the past, and because of this, we call this existentialism, and we can't discover any kind of meaning to it. It's like, okay, I hope that like that pain that I had in the past, or that school that I went to, and all the experiences of my past, I hope this will lead to some meaning. And all he can do is exist and make the best of what comes. That's the frustration of wisdom. Now, how do we get wisdom? Wisdom we get through experience, okay? You can't become wise without experience. And so that's why, as a child, they're a child, but through experience you gain wisdom, and you hope to make something of that. You hope there's meaning in life that comes from that. You don't want those experiences to go to waste. And all he can do is exist and make the best of what comes. He is saying that the best thinking a man can do on his own, apart from God, the best thinking a man can do, like you come up with you're the smartest person in the world. The best thinking a man can do on his own provides no answers to our misgivings, to our worries, and to our questions. No matter how smart you get in trying to discover the answers to why things happen in life, why we exist, you'll never discover the actual true meaning of it apart from God. Apart from God. You never will. Even if you study science, you'll never discover the origins of life. You'll never discover the meaning, the purpose behind why we exist, which comprises of a really good worldview, is to know that we have a purpose, we have a destiny, which atheism does not provide for anybody. But I like that he says that basically what he's saying is it's the occupational hazard of a wise man to walk by calculation rather than by faith. So wisdom limits, become apparent when faced with questions. In other words, like, When I have questions about why things happen in life, my earthly wisdom doesn't provide answers for them. So this travail or this burden of getting wisdom relates to the fact that life is filled with enigmas or mysteries that a person cannot resolve. So what he's saying is like, I'm the wisest man to ever live, and all the experiences I've gone through have not provided any kind of meaning for me apart from God. There's a lot of mysteries out there that I can't resolve. This is really frustrating. In other words, what he's saying is, the more wise I get, the more frustrated I become. When Katie had gone through her cancer, we had a lot of really good conversations with her oncologist, Dr. Deanna Mitchell. And we asked her if she was a believer, and she said she was. And we asked her if she had any hard cases. Of course, we know the answer to that. She's a children's oncologist. She's had many patients die. And she went on to explain one particular case in which she was very distraught. It was a single mother who lost her only child. And of course, it broke Deanna Mitchell's heart. You think of a doctor who, you know, their job is to save lives, and there was just nothing she could do to save this child's life. And through that situation, she questioned God. If God's good, why would he do something like this? And of course, you know, a lot of tears, a lot of crying, a lot of frustration for why God would allow this to happen, especially to this type of mother. We don't know all the situations involving that. You guys keeping an eye on him? All right, I just want to make sure. All right, somebody might want to catch him if he falls. Okay, you got him, Sandy? All right, good. Okay. Janine's not here to help him out. Is she in the nursery? Okay. Maybe somebody might want to sit next to him. That'd be great. Okay, thank you. So we asked her about this case, and I said, well, what do you do to resolve this? Because there's no answer to that whole situation, right? In other words, let me ask you this. Is there enough wisdom? Is there wisdom out there, enough wisdom out there that man can come up with to resolve this, to give an answer to why this child died? There is not, right? You can't read in a book of why this happened. You can't resolve this, the frustration of man's expectation and the realities of life. Man's wisdom can't resolve that tension. Does that make sense? Okay. So here she was, very, very smart lady. Couldn't resolve that tension. Okay. What's expected, we expect this child to live, but that wasn't reality. The child died. So God, what do we do here? Okay? And what she said to us was so profound. I've said this to our church many times. We said, well, how did you resolve that? Like that frustration and that maybe anger she had towards God. And this is what she did. This is what settled her soul. She said, I got to a point where I said to myself, I learned to let the mystery remain a mystery. In other words, there's no answer to it. Now, God knows, but we don't. And there's no amount of wisdom you can gather or gain on this earth that could ever answer questions like this. And so you have to get to a point in your Christian life where you say, God, you are God. You are sovereign. You are powerful. You're in control. And I'm going to trust you in these situations that seem so unjust in life. I'm going to let that mystery, I don't need an answer because you have it and I trust you. If you can't get to that place, you are going to be a very frustrated person. How many of you know of or been through an experience where you just don't have an answer for why it happened? Raise your hand. Okay? The question Solomon is answering is, there is no human answer to it. We just live in a sin-cursed world, okay? And things like this happen. Why do these parents who don't want kids keep having them, and these Christian parents who want to live for God can't have any? Why is it like that? And you have to get to a place to settle your soul and say, Lord, I don't know why you do this, but you're good, I'm not, and I'm going to let the mystery just remain a mystery. I'm going to trust you. That's what Solomon is saying. Look, I'm the wisest man who's ever lived, and I still am so frustrated with this wisdom because I don't have an answer. There is no meaning or purpose behind it apart from God. Now, how many guys take comfort in verses like Romans 8:28? All things work together for good to them that what? Love God. When you're like, okay, God, you are going to turn this bad situation into something good, so therefore my heart is going to trust you in this situation. Isn't that a great comfort? Okay, so wisdom is first gotten, by the way, when it comes to having wisdom, is first gotten by the fear of God, the fear of the Lord. The book of Proverbs teaches us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, right? Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't become wise, but what I am saying is when human reasoning doesn't answer your toughest questions, you have to trust God in that. But you're never going to get wisdom without having a respect, a healthy respect and fear of the Lord. Okay? It amazes to me to see a creature that God has created, a human being, disrespect God. You know, it's like, you know, they're mad at him and frustrated with God. And or they just disregard God as if he doesn't exist while he's clearly shown himself to them in amazing ways. Here's the problem: if you disrespect God, you'll never become wise. You say, I don't understand why I should be wise. Like, why should I pursue wisdom if it only leads to frustration? We still have to have answers, don't we? We still have to be wise in our relationships and wise in our business dealings, and we still need to be wise in these areas. But what Solomon is saying is that even with all the wisdom that this world has to offer, it still doesn't resolve some of the frustrations and injustices that we go through in life. But I will say this phrase, maybe write this down. All truth, all wisdom, all truth is God's truth. All truth is God's truth. Whenever you hear a truth, it originates with God. Even if a philosopher or a doctor comes up with, they do a study and they come to a truth, you can always trace that truth back to the Bible. You know, they'll say, in parenting, now we should probably discipline our kids and we should give them structure. And that's what the Bible said this whole time. you know, it always comes back to God. I mean, 2 + 2 = 4 because God made it that way. Okay, you know, our biological gender was given to us by God. And if you're biologically a female or biologically a male, that truth comes from God. Okay, and we can go about changing those truths all we want, pretend that these realities don't exist, but they exist because all truth is God's truth. But sometimes God doesn't give us an answer about life situations and the realities of life, except to just trust in him. Okay, except to just trust in him. There are so many stories in the Bible where the man of God or the woman of God was so frustrated with life's injustices. You think of people like Paul, you think of John. Remember John the Baptist? Man, this is the guy who grew a beard, was eating honey and locusts and preaching repentance. Man, this guy was on fire for God. And at the end of his life, when he was thrown into prison, he says, is this really the one, or should we look for another? I mean, he was asking this same question in that we find in Ecclesiastes, is like, is this really real? Like, is this Jesus really the one? How many of you guys have ever been there before? I just feel like in my situation, there is no answer. And they're really, you know, he died. He lost his head. But in the end, of course, he's in heaven, and those answers are all solved and resolved. But sometimes God doesn't give us an answer. He just expects us to trust in him. I'll tell you this. As a Christian, I take great comfort in knowing that when I don't have an answer, I can go to the one who does, and even if he doesn't give me the answer, I just trust him anyway. Okay? Some of you have gone through horrible situations. Horrible, horrible. And I'll just tell you, the only way to settle your question and your heart in that situation is to look to God and say, God, you're sovereign. That means he's in control, and he can turn that bad situation into something very amazing if you trust in him. And you can have peace and comfort in this life. All right, now verse number 14 through 15, notice what it says. He says this, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. There are so many who are aiming at unsubstantial ideals, which blow away like the wind. Their efforts to straighten things out and supply what seems to be lacking are continually disappointed. In other words, we have corrected many wrongs in the past, right? A lot of injustices. How many guys understand what he's saying here is that no matter how many laws we pass, no matter how much philanthropy we're involved in, bad things continue to happen. Right? Like no matter how many times something crooked is made straight, something crooked always still happens. Isn't that frustrating? It's like we can go ahead and take all the guns away from all the law-abiding citizens and some people will still die from shootings. And you could take all the knives away from everybody who has knives and somebody will still make something sharp and stab somebody. It just, you're never going to create a utopia in this world based on all the work and labor that needs to be done to correct all the wrongs. It just seems like you're chasing the wind in this area. We think of segregation. I think that's something that I'm so thankful that our country resolved that back in the 1960s, but it still didn't absolve racism. Now, I think there's less racism in our country, but it just because you pass a law doesn't eradicate people hating others based on the color of their skin or disliking somebody based on their religion or disliking somebody based on their wealth or lack of wealth or what neighborhood they live in. It comes in all forms, okay? You're still not going to make the world straight by passing a whole bunch of laws. That's the frustration. He goes, I'm trying to like fix everything and it just doesn't seem to get fixed. Once we finish a war, another one's going to start. We can ban abortion, but women are going to still murder their baby. And I'm not saying we shouldn't ban abortion. We shouldn't pursue that. And by the way, I want to be clear about where I stand on this. I think that killing and aborting what God has created is a major injustice. And I don't think that should have ever been made legal. It's one of the greatest tragedies in American history. But even if you pass a law, there are women who would still want their baby to be aborted. When I think of murder is obviously on the books as being illegal, yet it still happens. Rape is illegal, yet it still happens. Okay? A fundamental human problem, and is what he's saying, a fundamental human problem resides in a lack of harmony between common human aspirations and reality itself. Like what we aspire life to be like, okay, what we want in this life, this utopian life, and the reality of life, there seems to lack harmony. And it seems to be futile, okay? People refuse to accept things as they are. In other words, notice what he says in verse number 15. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. In other words, it doesn't matter how much we strive to make life better, it just seems like we can't make it straight ever. Now, how many of you guys just know that we should strive to help our neighbor, and we should try to make help people in our realm of influence and make our church better and all those sorts of things, but it's still never going to eradicate sin and bad and evil in this world. Listen, here's what I'm saying. As a Christian, you just have to accept evil will always exist in this world. It's never going to be gone. And no politician's ever going to resolve that. No amount of money you pump into the schools are going to make all the students better now. You see what I'm saying? We could do our part. We should do that, especially in our home, in our church, in our workplace, and we should try to make a difference, but evil's always going to exist. You know, you can just like go home tonight and be like, well, if that's the case, I just give up. Okay. Well, you're still part of something eternal. You're still part of something that that will make an impact, okay? But it's just going to, it's a fundamental human problem that resides, is this lack of harmony between common human aspirations and reality itself. And so people just refuse to accept that this is what life is all about. This is what life, the reality of life is. So look at verses 16 and 17. It says, I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So those who attempt to find the meaning of life and those who abandon it both find it frustrating. Okay, those who attempt to find the meaning of life and those who abandon that, it's like, just forget it. I'm just going to eat, drink, and be merry, then I'm going to die. Both find life completely frustrating. All because his thinking is earthbound and going nowhere. So trying to understand how the world works, why things happen as they do, and how one might change these realities often produces pain and agitation. So once you learn the enormity and complexity of the problems, the more apparent human limits become. That's why he says at the end, for in much wisdom is much, what? Grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Isn't that interesting? That the more you learn, what you're learning is the enormity and complexity of the problems that you're learning. And the more apparent our human limits are, that I can't control this. And then therefore we become more burdened and more frustrated, because the more we learn, the more burdensome it gets. Could you imagine what it's like for God? He knows everything. You think you're frustrated with the injustices and complexities and burdens of life. Just imagine, God knows everything. I'm surprised he hasn't come back yet, Viral. Yet there's a plenty of good to go around and faith that he sees. So that's the frustration of wisdom. The frustration of wisdom. Now, should tonight's lesson teach us that we shouldn't pursue wisdom because it's only going to lead to more frustration and complexity? No. It means this, is that you should continue to pursue wisdom because that's extremely important. If you lack wisdom, you become double-minded, and a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways, and you're going to live a very frustrated life. But what it's saying is, as you gain wisdom, the parts of your wisdom that you don't have an answer for, or the issues you can't resolve on your own in your own strength, it's so just give it to God. Okay? There's some of you, you have a kid that's wayward and they're not living for God, and they're in some other state and you're worried about them. You're kind of wringing your hands about that whole situation. You know what you need to do in that situation? Just give it to God. Say, God, you love that child even more than I do. And Lord, I pray that you would get a hold of their heart. Some of you want to, and you want to try to fix it on your own. You can't do it. You can't do it. You're going to get frustrated if you try. Okay? Give it to God. Do what you can. And then number two, I want you to see the frustrations of unlimited wealth. The frustrations of unlimited wealth. Now, most people, unlimited money suggests unlimited satisfaction and a life filled with happiness and meaning, right? Isn't that why we play the Michigan Powerball or lottery? I don't even know. I don't play it. Isn't that why people play the lottery? Isn't that why people buy scratchers? Because if I become wealthy, I'll have unlimited satisfaction and happiness and meaning. And if I become rich, it'll solve all my problems. Really? Is that true? Is it really going to do that? Because every lotto winner would experience that, right? Right? But they don't. Look at verses 1 and 2. I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is what? Vanity, emptiness. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? So interesting when it comes to wealth. This guy was very wealthy. And let's just talk about a few of those wealthy luxuries he enjoyed. He's given to the joys of luxury here. He's given to it. He's He's pursuing. He's trying to find meaning in this luxury. Solomon tries to find meaning and pleasure by cheering himself up with wine while still being guided by wisdom. You see that in verse 3. I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine. Now, he wants to indulge, to experience pleasure without losing any kind of rational control. So some people think that's what life is all about. That's what life's all about. I enjoy a good laugh, yet it doesn't provide any meaning in life. I'm going to drink, I want to just enjoy a little sitcom or go to a comedy show or something like that, and I'm going to enjoy these things, yet it doesn't provide any answers or meaning to life. Yes, does it give you a sense of escape from the pains of life? Of course. How many of you enjoyed a good sitcom before? Right? How many of you guys have ever been to a comedy show? Okay, my wife and I have been and saw Brian Regan a couple of times. It's hilarious. It was a lot of fun for an hour, but it didn't give us any answers to life. It didn't solve any of our problems. We didn't leave there and go, man, our marriage is so much better because we went and saw Brian Regan. It didn't answer any. It gave us a reprieve for an hour, and that was a lot of fun. And that's what Solomon is saying here. He's saying, I've indulged in these things, yet it didn't provide any answers. Notice he says, I said in my heart, he said, this is what I said to myself. Go to now and I'll prove thee with mirth, with laughter, with enjoyment. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what does it? He's saying, I have all these people that I purchase, jesters maybe, people that make me laugh, and he goes, it's not even doing anything. Yeah, I have a good laugh, but it's not providing any kind of meaning in life. It doesn't provide, but it does provide a moment of relief from reality. In verse number 3, let's look at that again. Speaking of turning to sensual pleasure, in verse 3 he says, I sought in my heart and gave myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. He now turns to sensual pleasure. Yet he still kept a hold of himself so that he could analyze his experience. So in other words, I drank enough that I can like still be conscious of where I am and what I'm doing. I can analyze my experience, but also enjoy pleasures at the same time. So he took on the philosophy of life that many people even take today, to eat, to drink, for tomorrow we die. Just enjoy the pleasures, just indulge into the pleasures of this life, because, I mean, what's the point? We're all going to die anyway. In fact, that's what Isaiah 22:13 says, and this has been a philosophy from day one. And behold, joy and gladness, slaying oxen and killing sheep and eating flesh and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow, what? We shall die. Okay, that phrase is as old as Isaiah, all right? It's like, well, I mean, in this life, we just eat, drink, and die, so might as well just indulge in as much of it as we possibly can. And what Solomon is saying is that life is so absolutely and utterly empty. You know why? Because it's void of relationships with God and with people that are meaningful. I like verses 4-8. I'm just going to kind of go through this. It says, I made me great works. I builded houses. Like, okay, I tried pleasure. I tried laughter. That was a lot of fun, trying, you know, like getting some jokes, drink a little wine, have a little pleasure. But I just found it to be empty. And then he says, well, then I tried this. I made me great works, builded me houses, planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards and planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. Wow. Look at verse 6. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments and that of all sorts. So this is really interesting because expresses himself, he expresses this himself with extensive building projects, with vineyards, fruit trees, gardens, music, dancers, you name it, he was able to purchase it. If he thought, oh, this will give me meaning, this will give me purpose, this will give me life, he was able to just buy it. I mean, he had servants born in his house. And it's amazing what he's saying is all of it's empty. I had, when I was at UPS this week, I had a coworker get all excited. He just got all excited. He goes, oh, man. I said, what's going on? He goes, oh, Eminem's new album just dropped this morning. Eminem, his new album just dropped this morning. You know what I thought when he said that? I was like, that'll be old in a week. You know, you think about all the new music albums that come. By the way, I don't condone Eminem. I guess what he told me is like, yeah, this album's about taking away people's guns and, you know, all that stuff. I'm like, are you serious? Isn't this the same guy that rapped about, like, murdering people and killing his wife's boyfriend and all this other junk? It's unbelievable how people think today. But all this would get old. You know, I was making a hospital visit, and Billy Ray Cyrus's song "Achy Breaky Heart" was on, and all these people were singing it. Do you remember when that was popular? "Don't break my heart, my achy breaky heart." Now, some of you guys weren't even born during that time. I found that song very annoying, by the way. It's horribly annoying. Yeah, it was bad. But I'll just tell you, everything that man creates, haven't you found that it always gets old? Have you ever just like, oh man, this music, oh, it fills me up. And then over time you listen to it too much, you start to hate it. Right? You're like, oh, it's kind of annoying now. Right? Things just get old because it's empty. That's the frustration he's sharing with us here. It's like all these singers and all these dancers and all the vineyards, it's like it's great and it was fun building it, but then it just doesn't provide what I thought it would. It gets old. Verses 9 through 11, notice what it says. It says, so I was great. A little humility there, wasn't it? So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem, also by wisdom remained with me. Now, let me just say this. What he's saying here is, look, if you want, what he's saying to you is, look, I've been there. I've pursued all of these dreams and aspirations that man tries to pursue, and I've accomplished it, and I'm just telling you. He says, I'm telling you, it's empty. And whatsoever my eye desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. Then I looked on all the work that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was what? Vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was what? No profit under the sun. Wow. What powerful words. In other words, no amount of money or pleasure this life offers cannot lift us out of the realm of earthbound frustration. Music, travel, houses, things are never going to resolve this tension between our expectation and the reality that they don't fulfill our heart. So let me ask you this question. What does fulfill our heart? And should we just not pursue travel? Should we not build a house? Should we never grow our business? And should we not mow our lawns? And should we not build gardens in our house? Like, is that what the Bible is teaching here? That's not what the Bible is teaching. What the Bible is teaching is if you're trying to find meaning and fulfillment in all those things, you'll always find that it's empty every single time. You're just going to have this frustration in life because you're not living a God-centered life. Okay? That's why he's saying at the end, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and what? Keep his commandments. He goes, what he's saying is, it's in those moments that I feel the most fulfillment in life. How many of you guys ever seen the movie Citizen Kane? Wow. Okay, Viral and Lois. It's a black and white film. I actually highly encourage you to see this movie. It's extremely powerful of what I'm about to say. It illustrates everything I'm saying tonight so perfectly. Here's a guy who risen out of poverty. Okay, very poor. His family is very poor. And this guy accumulated so much wealth and power. But what's so sad about the movie, this is a classic 1941 movie, is that he finds no fulfillment in it all. Zero. If you've ever seen Citizen Kane, it is a classic. At the end of the movie is the most powerful part of the movie. So if you've never seen it, I'm going to give the ending away. Okay? Spoiler alert. Okay? Is he literally built a mansion to fill all of his belongings and stuff. At the end of the movie, he has no relationships with anybody, and he hates life. He's frustrated, and he's a very angry man. And in his basement is filled with, like, tons of stuff that he'd given his heart to. Jewels and, you know, knickknacks and like, just stuff. I mean, and his house is completely filled with it. And he's lying on his deathbed, and he's reflecting back on his childhood, and he sees that the closest he ever got to satisfaction and fulfillment was in his childhood. That's the closest he ever felt fulfilled and satisfied, poor, and with his family. In fact, in the fire, they take all his belongings and they're throwing it in this furnace, and the camera zooms in on one of his favorite toys as a child, as it's burning up. And at the end of the movie, the camera pans away from the house, his mansion, dead in his bed, and all these servants throwing all of his possessions he gave his life to into a fire. And what you see as the camera pans out is the smoke of all his belongings going up into the air. It was all a waste. It took everything he lived for and threw it in a fire. And you got to think about that with your life. Everything you're pursuing, all the possessions you're gaining, all of it will one day get burnt up. It's going to be done. And you'll find at the end of your life, the only things that mattered most was your relationships with people and your relationship with God. Those are the only things that matter the most. And so I've entitled the message tonight, The Tensions of Life. The Tensions of Life. And we see here Solomon is saying, look, I've pursued all these things. I've tried all these things. And I found them all to be so, so empty. The way you find fulfillment and satisfaction and meaning in your life is to pursue the heart of God. And when you do that, you will be fulfilled.